I've been stressing over this passage since the beginning of August when I had to preach it. And the reason being for that is because I couldn't close some of the holes that I was working through. Right? There were a lot of challenges for me as I was reading this because I was getting so triggered by what I was reading. I'm like, how can this be? How can God want this from us? How can he allow us to take so much abuse? Something's got to be wrong. Like something here, I must be reading it wrong or I must be understanding it wrong. There must be something wrong with my reading. And so I went to all my commentaries and read all the chapters there and, again, was left unfulfilled by what I was reading. I listened to at least 4 or 5 sermons, at least an hour long, and no one actually was dealing with the text the way that I was seeing that it should have been dealt with. And these are men that I respected, and a lot of them tried to minimize the text because, again, if you read the words as you heard this morning, some of them are very challenging. And it got to a point where every single day I was less and less comfortable with my interpretation of the passage. And Hannah was there the entire time. She was watching me like talk to myself. I was pacing. I was talking to her. I was asking her questions. We were going back and forth about this topic. And then I'd be in the shower. I'd be talking to myself again. And then I'd be talking to other people. And then I finally got it down. I got something down the first Sunday in August, and I still wasn't quite happy with it, but it had basically what I had thought through. And then I wasn't able to preach it that Sunday. And then I was just going to put it aside for a little bit to give it some more thought. But I was pretty comfortable with what I'd written. And then I had a friend over for dinner who brought something else out that I hadn't thought about in this passage. So then it caused me to freak out again. I was freaking out pretty much until Friday, where I had a short, maybe 5 or 10 minute conversation with Pastor Warner. He said just like maybe 5 words or 6 words the entire time, and I think I worked it out. But I think anybody reading this passage, there is such weight and such radicalness that God is calling us to here that we need to take the words of here seriously, but really think through what the meaning is. So I encourage all of you and invite all of you to read this passage with me, to reason with me, and let God bless the reading of his corporate word. And if you think I'm really off, let me know at the end of the service. All right, but I'm gonna tell you what I think this passage means, and I'm going to show you from the scriptures what I think they mean. I think this is what God's intention was for this passage. And if it is, then I think we need to live this way as well. But let's go to the passage. All right? So the first part of this passage goes, "You have heard that it was said, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth, but I say to you, do not resist the one who is evil." Now, in the Old Testament, specifically within the first 5 books, this phrase, an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth, is said 3 times. So it's actually something that's very common for a lot of Jewish people in the synagogue to have heard before. Right? In fact, there's an entire law that's based around this called the Lex Talionis, which is the law of retaliation. Right? So basically, there are ways in which people have dealt with these things in the courts, ways in which they're supposed to deal with them in their personal life. So many Jewish people are very familiar with this passage. And each of the passages that we look at here, so there's 3 passages, like I said. So you can see this in Exodus chapter 21, verse 24, Leviticus chapter 24, verse 20, and Deuteronomy 19, verse 21. It basically says the same thing here. Now, in each of the contexts of these passages, it's often in the form or in the view of a formal trial, right? It's meant as a command for the nation and not to be a way in which we're supposed to deal with one another individually. However, the problem that a lot of the Jewish people were running into was they completely misunderstood what this passage meant, right? That they misunderstood that it was supposed to be meant for a nation, meant for a way that the nation should judge the people if a situation comes up, right? A way that we could kind of weigh the scales between 2 sides and then give the right side what they should be owed and then to punish the wrong side. But a lot of people began to use this as a way that they would live their own personal lives. Now, I want you to imagine back the story about my niece, Olivia. And it's basically like telling her like what we told her before, right? So if she scratches you in the face, scratch her back in the face. If she pokes you in the eye, jab her back in the eye, right? I want you to imagine if we all did the same thing. If we treated all of our relationships an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth, right? Whatever you do to me, I'm going to do back to you. And you can imagine the damage that we would do to one another if that were the case. Jesus, he responds with a bombshell by telling us, do not resist these people, these evil people. And what Jesus meant by this is Jesus foresaw that there would be bad people whose intent was to take advantage of the disciples. And what is stunning about what Jesus is saying here is just because that they are bad, it doesn't allow the disciples to resist them. Not actively or passively, not with force or without force. This is a pretty explosive comment to make, right? Right, that number one, he establishes that there will be evil people who will try to take advantage of them, and instead of fighting them or challenging them personally, Jesus tells them to not resist. Now you can start to think about, start to imagine the difficulty I had, right? Like I could think of 1,000 different abuses if we allow things to occur. Right? If you just go off the top of your head, there's got to be like 3 or 4 things you could throw up right off the top of your head if we just allow evil, if it continues, if we don't resist it, then it's just going to keep on. Yet this is Jesus' words to us, and I think this is to be taken seriously, that we are not to resist these people. Jesus is telling us in this situation that believers should rather receive more Jesus is telling us here that that what we have here is that there's a calling from him that the way that we should live in this world. Now, I just started to think about this week about what are some of the reasons why this really triggers me, why this really gets me going, right? And I came up with 2 reasons here, and maybe there's more, but these are the 2 that I thought were the most prominent that I was thinking about. Number one is that we want the right to peace and security, and we don't want people to infringe upon our security and equality, right? We basically don't want people to deal with the harmony that we live in. We don't want people to aggravate us. We want to be able to live the way that we want to live. Now, we're going to deal with this point later. Now, the second one that I think that I was quite triggered by was we want the right to instantaneous justice. But I want you to imagine, I want you to think about when somebody does something bad to you, when someone hits you or says something bad about you, or if they push you, the first thing that you want to happen is you want to push them back. Or maybe you want to pray and you want a rock to fall on them. Right? Maybe that's the way you pray. But the idea here is that we want justice. We don't want to see these things happen. We want the right thing to happen right now. And oftentimes, we don't want just to pray for justice. We want to dispense justice. We want to be the ones who do justice, right? So we want to be the Batman, the vigilante who does right, who basically everyone cheers at the end of the day, hooray, you did a great thing. But you're the one who dispensed justice. That's what we want. And we want things in the world to be right based on our morality. What's interesting here, as we think about this last part about the instantaneous justice that we want, is that God gives us nothing of the sort. We have no right to this justice in one sense. God tells us to not judge evil, but it is his right to judge evil. As he says in Hebrews chapter 10, verse 30, for we know him who said, vengeance is mine, I will repay. And again, the Lord will judge his people. And so as we look at the idea of justice, it's intertwined with this idea of our faith, right? That it's God who is the one who's the judge. It's not us who is the judge. And so we must leave that to him. Now, this is a hard saying, and it's going to come up again and again as we read a couple of these scenarios, because you're going to continue to read these things, get more triggered, and continually ask, number one, where is the justice? And number two, where are my rights? Those are 2 things you're going to ask as we look at some of these examples. So let's look at these examples here. All right, so in the next portion, verses, the second part of verse 39 to 40, we're going to see 4 examples that Jesus is going to give us. And the idea here, these are four very specific but radical examples of how he expects Christians to react to non-resistance. Let's look at the first one. All right, but if anyone slaps you on the right cheek, turn to him the other cheek also. Now, Today, probably back in those days, when someone slaps you on the cheek, it's not supposedly just to hurt you. The idea here is it's supposed to be insulting, right? So a front-handed slap is pretty insulting, but we all know that a backhanded slap is probably more insulting, mainly because it's recognized that I just don't respect you. I'm going to hit you in the face. And so what Jesus is talking about here wasn't just a painful blow, but was meant as a gross insult, right? So basically, someone is insulting you to your right cheek. Now, under the law, you actually could get compensation for this. You can go before a court and seek some compensation. And not only that, and something else that we're confronted with in this passage is not only do we want to take them to court to make them pay out money for slapping me on the cheek and causing me distress and causing me to be offended, but also I want to lay on hands to someone who slaps me on the cheek, right? Not only do I want to lay on hands here, I don't want to even just trade slap for slap, right? I might want to drop an elbow in there. I want to throw a kick in there. I want to watch all these karate movies and use those moves in this fight. Like, I really want justice. I really want to put this person down. And as you can see, oftentimes when we're offended in such a way, what we want is not equality or equal treatment or what they deserve. What we want is we want the other person just to stop what they're doing. It's not about justice any longer. Jesus tells us in the situation that believers should rather receive more disrespect by being slapped on the other cheek than to take this before the court or respond back in force. And that, if we are his disciples, we give up all desire for retribution, both physically and legally. Are you triggered yet? I don't know how many of you guys have experienced this kind of disrespect before, but I'm sure everybody in some way has had to deal with some kind of confrontation where they were not happy with, where they felt like they were wronged. I want you to think back to that moment when you had that. What is the response that you felt? What did you want to do? And when it came to it, what stopped you? Hopefully you didn't go through with the force, but what stopped you from going forward and causing this person harm? Now, some people have used this passage to say that all Christians everywhere at all times should be pacifists, right? And I think that in our personal situations, I think this is true, that we are called to be passive as possible. However, there are a number of qualifiers here. Number one is that I think these situations are specifically applicable to personal situations. If other people's lives are at risk or things like that, if there is greater evil, if there's something that we have to step in to do greater good, I think some of these circumstances do change. So I don't think this is like you should apply this in every single circumstance that's similar to it. Number two is that I do not think this applies to life and death situations, right? So if your life is on the line, it doesn't mean that you shouldn't fight back. In Luke chapter 22, verse 36, Jesus is talking to the disciples, and he's just about to be killed. He's about to be crucified, and he's going to be raised from the dead. And he's going to be ascended. He's going to be in glory. And so what happens is Jesus starts to prepare his disciples for what they need to prepare their lives for and the things they need to gather to be ready for the trip. So some of the things that he tells them that they need to get are like knapsacks, things of that nature. But he also tells them that they should get swords. Now the question is, why would Jesus tell them to get swords? And I think the reason is because he's telling them, you may have to defend yourselves. So you guys should have swords on hand to defend yourselves. Now I will say that as we look at the book of Acts, not once do they take out the sword to defend themselves. However, I do think that Jesus does leave this as an option for his disciples if something were to occur that they could defend themselves. Third, it doesn't mean that you shouldn't just try to avoid the situation or run away. It's not like you're opening yourself up, please slap me and slap me again. Do it again. Right? We're not goading them. We're not asking for it. There is the option to run away and to avoid these things. So if you can get away from these things, I'm not telling you that you need to stand for a second slap in the face if something like this happens. Now, this is the first situation. And Jesus goes into a second situation, again, that does kind of involve a legal situation here. Right, so the second situation here he deals with is, and if anyone would sue you also for your tunic, let him have your cloak as well. So in this case, Jesus is talking about a hypothetical situation. No court case has ever been found, at least in that time frame, where someone would actually sue the shirt off someone's back. But if someone's suing somebody else for their tunic. Right? Now, this is actually a pretty big deal. And because Jesus tells them that you should give them your cloak as well. Now, the cloak in this situation was actually an inalienable right to the Jewish people. So any Jewish person that would hear this passage, the first thing they would say is, wait. You're telling me that I need to give them this piece of clothing, which is mine by right, right? Legally, this is mine. They cannot take this, right? If we read Exodus chapter 22, verse 25 to 27, there are certain things, specifically the undercoat or the coat, that are ours by right, that they cannot sue us for. And here, Jesus says something so spectacular that says that if he wants your tunic, give him that as well. Now, inside me, as I heard this, I was thinking, and I was saying to myself, you know, that's mine. No matter what I've done to you, this is mine. And if you want to take this, I want to be bitter, I want to be petty, I want to be selfish. Yet Jesus says to us here, to generously give up anything, give it up, showing us that we are prepared to abandon what is ours by right. Again, this passage got me going, because just think about the situations that you could run into with this. But Paul makes this even more clear between believers, right? He says in 1 Corinthians chapter 6, verse 7, make this especially true between believers. So to have the lawsuit at all with one another is already a defeat for you. Why not rather suffer wrong? Why not rather be defrauded? Right? So the first thing is we're abandoning our right to pride and our right to honor. Maybe there's some physical aspects that we're abandoning our rights to. The second one is we're abandoning our rights to things that we are technically belong to us by right. Now, moving to verse 41, Jesus moves a little bit away. He moves away from this passage, moving away from the legal situation, and he moves more to the personal grounds, some of the more personal things that they would be dealing with from verse 41. Let's look at verse 41 here. And if anyone forces you to go a mile, go with him 2 miles. Okay, so what does this mean? So this might seem odd to us today, but back in that era, a Roman soldier could enlist somebody to take up all of their stuff, you know, enlist them into general labor, and they would have to take that stuff for a mile, carry that for a mile for this soldier. So for instance, I might be walking down the street and I'm a Roman soldier and I see Keith. I'm like, hey, Keith, do me a great favor. No, I don't even care if you want to do me a favor. You got to do this anyways. So grab all my stuff, carry this for me, and we're going to walk a mile. Now, they were legally only limited to a mile. This is their they are only required to go 1 mile. But this is the soldier's right. He could do that. And you could imagine, if you're a conquered people, if you're a people that was conquered by Rome, your natural response to a Roman soldier would be, I really don't want to do this. And I want to find every way that I can to fight this, to stop this from happening. I don't want to walk a mile. I've got things to do. I've got family to take care of. I've got a job to do. You might also be thinking, hey, I want to fight back, right? I don't want to have you abuse my rights. Yet, in this passage, Jesus doesn't give us that option. There is no fighting back. There's no rights to time. And we are simply not just to do what is required, but to do over and above what is required. So, again, a very interesting situation because, again, we don't see this very often in Canada, but something that does speak a lot about what it means here. Now, you might start asking yourselves, what does this have to do with retaliation? Now, Jesus is giving us something a little bit more than just about retaliation. He's telling us what we should be doing. And we'll be touching upon this a little bit later on. But let's move on here. Verse 42. It says, "Give to the one who begs from you, and do not refuse the one who would borrow from you." Now, for someone to beg from you, generally speaking, this is a need that they have. This is actually something that they really need, a necessity of life that they need from you. And what Jesus is saying to us here is that we need to give openly and freely to the people who are in need. Now, that also doesn't mean that we shouldn't be discerning, right? Now, there are a number of reasons why I believe this. I think there are a number of Old Testament passages, specifically in Proverbs, that talk about giving money to somebody or putting up a guarantee or a safety to somebody who's a stranger. But also, if you look at like 2 Thessalonians chapter 3, verse 10, it says, "If anyone is not willing to work, let him not eat." Right? So again, we're assuming that this person is asking for food even though they haven't worked a single day. And Paul is telling you, hey, don't give him food because he hasn't worked. So I think there is a level which we're to be discerning here, right? Not to give, to just give without thinking about consequences. I think we need to give but thinking about them. However, the second part of it is you need to give openly and freely. And this is both in quantity and quality. Let me read Deuteronomy chapter 15, verse 7 to 11 for you here. "If anyone is poor among your fellow Israelites in any of the towns of the land of the Lord your God is giving you, do not be hard-hearted or tight-fisted towards them. Rather, be open-handed and freely lend to them whatever they need. Be careful not to harbor this wicked thought. The seventh year, the year for canceling debts, is near, so that you do not show ill will towards the needy among your fellow Israelites and give them nothing. They may then appeal to the Lord against you, and you will be found guilty of sin. Give generously to them, and do so without a begrudging heart. Then because of this, the Lord your God will bless you in all of your work and everything you put your hand to. There will always be poor people in the land. Therefore, I command you to be open-handed towards your fellow Israelites who are poor and needy in your land." So Jesus here is talking about this idea that if there is somebody among you, someone who is in need, and they need something in the necessity of life, we are called to give abundantly as we can. Right? He doesn't talk about a limit. He doesn't say only up to $1,500. Right? He says if they have need, then you should give it. You should lend it. So here's my question for you guys. Just one last point here. Jesus also talks about this idea here that not only do we not have rights over all the things that we talked about before, but we don't have rights to our possessions, right? That the things that we own, actually, we don't have full rights to them. We can't just take them for ourselves and hoard them for ourselves. So we're going to move on to this big question now. Are you uncomfortable yet? You know, we all sit in pews, feel pretty good. Right? But after talking about what we talked about today, do you feel comfortable? Because I think the idea here is that we should feel uncomfortable. And if you right now don't feel uncomfortable with what you've read, we haven't read the passage correctly, or B, we haven't actually understood it the right way. But the idea here is that really should leave us uncomfortable, right? Who here has done the four things that we've talked about perfectly? I'd probably guess none of us, including myself. And I think the reason that we are so uncomfortable is because of the force of the meaning of this passage. That this is what Jesus means for us to die to ourselves. So I think what Jesus is talking about in this passage specifically is that we are called to die to ourselves. Now, the question you may also be asking is, okay, so die to myself. So, you know, what is the purpose of living this way then? Right? Why would I go to such great lengths? I think we are to live this way so that men will see our good works and our good life and come to be reconciled to God, as it says in Matthew chapter 5, verses 15 to 16. Verse 14, let's start with verse 14. "You are the light of the world. A town built on a hill cannot be hidden. Neither do people light a lamp and put a bowl under a lamp and put it under a bowl. Instead, they put it on a stand and give it light to everyone in the house. In the same way, let your light shine before others, that they may see your good deeds and glorify your Father in heaven." So the idea here is that the reason why we live this way, the reason why we do these things, is so that our Father in heaven might be glorified, so that people can see that we're so different, that we live in such a radical way, that people can see that this is the God who's transformed us, this is the God who's alive, the God who's at work, and working through us to impact you. Let me give you an example of what this is like in the curious life, or the curious case of Billy Bray. So Billy Bray was a 19th century evangelist. But before he became an evangelist, he was actually a quite well-known fighter in his own town. Again, of course, last night was fight night. We all could talk about that. Move on. Let's move on from that now. Billy Bray was a fighter. He's quite well-known in his own location. And Billy Bray, after he became a fighter, ended up becoming a miner. But everybody feared Billy Bray. Right, Billy Bray was the kind of guy who's a tough guy. You wouldn't want to spend too much time near him because he's the rough and tumble kind of type. And he was also known as an alcoholic, and he was not a very nice alcoholic. So he was very, very bitter, very, very physical. And on top of that, most people saw him as kind of a very vile person. Well, Billy Bray one day had a very powerful experience of Christ and of God. After receiving the Bible, after reading Pilgrim's Progress by John Bunyan, and he came to know the Lord after that time, and his entire life changed and was flipped upside down. Now, many people in his town who had feared Billy Bray had heard about his conversion and thought it was a good chance now to get even. Right, this person who had caused fear and caused caused terror across all these people. One of these guys felt like, it's time. It's time for me to get even. So he walked down the street, he saw Billy Bray, and he struck him in the face. All right, comes back to the question, right? So my niece Olivia, what do you do? Right, what do you do now? Billy Bray, the old Billy Bray, would have squashed this man like a bug. He would have powerbombed him, he would have thrown him across the room, he would have sent him to the other end of the city. If this were the old Billy Bray. But the new Billy Bray, the Billy Bray that has been transformed, said, "May God forgive you, even as I forgive you." And this man who struck Billy Bray, or struck Billy, was so tormented by Billy's words that he became a Christian too. He saw the transformation in Billy's life. And this is one of the stories in which we can see that as people see the transformation that God has done in your life, as people are setting their hearts captive to what God desires, there is a transformative, or there is a recognizing effect that you are automatically different, and they want to know what is the reason for the hope that you have. But if you do not live that way, people don't think that you have hope. Now, it's very important here that we talk about this idea that I don't think we are supposed to have a very mechanical interpretation of this passage, meaning that if situations look like this that are similar, that we need to always act in the same way. So for instance, say I'm walking down the street and I see like a bunch of people beating up Joe, and I'm like, oh, I'm going to not walk that way because Joe's getting beat up, so I won't have to get into trouble. Right? It's almost similar, right? Because I could kind of be in Joe's place, so I'm just going to walk away from the situation. I don't think that in similar situations we're always talking about that you need to live this way. I do think, however, though, that without context, that Jesus is still calling us to live this way. So if there is a context that is like this, that you are called to do what he said in this passage. But oftentimes, as we look at the context of a situation, oftentimes as we consider what's happening, what the meaning is, it does change the way that we react to things that are happening in the world. And I think that even within the passages and in the New Testament, we can see that different circumstances change the way that people act, and that we don't always act in the same way in similar situations. All right? So again, if Joe is being beaten up on the street, don't just walk away. Right? Step in. Help him out. Probably not going to happen, but again, if he's in trouble, go help him out. Now, what I do think that this passage does tell us, without a shadow of a doubt, this is the one thing I've always been clear about, is that he expects us to live this radically. Now, one of the points that we brought up earlier was, you know, we don't want someone to infringe upon our rights. We want security and we want equality. But this misses the point of our Christian purpose. This misses the point of our Christian purpose. This is what God expects from us, and also is the guide for our actions. God expects, number one, is that all the things that we do, whether we eat or drink, as it says in 1 Corinthians 10, verse 31, is to all of it is to the glory of God. And the second thing that we should be considerate about is to love our neighbor. You know, as we look at this passage, it's not good enough to just say that we're going to do these things to fight evil. Right? Because in this passage, it makes very clear that we should not do these things to resist evil. Right? It says it right in this passage. However, I do think that the way that we look at glorifying God, the way that we look at loving our neighbor, does change the way that we act. Let's use the instance of giving to the poor. In this passage, I think it's very clear that we should be giving to the poor. And in fact, we should be giving whenever we are asked. Right? This in itself is a hard command. What makes it even harder is sometimes not everybody who is asking is doing it just for the necessities of life. There are other maybe sinful allures that they might be using that money for. And this passage isn't just telling us to just give them unaware of what's going to happen. We should be considerate about what's going to happen. We should be considerate what's happening. But this shouldn't stop our giving. But what it should do, we should ask, is instead of giving you money, can I buy you a meal instead? Right? So this is challenging for multiple ways. Number one is that it's challenging us is that there's still a command here that we need to do. And the command here is to give. But the second thing, which maybe for all of us here is much harder, is we do not live out these things mechanically. And some of these things do require us to think about, A, does this bring greater glory to God? Or number two, does this actually love the other person? Right? So I think that these are things that we need to think about as we're thinking about living out these commands. Number two here is that we need to die to ourselves. Now, dying to yourself sounds really easy. Oftentimes when we say it, we might sing songs about dying to ourselves. And we might just think, hey, I'm just going to sacrifice something. So I'm going to give, I'm going to write a little check. Here's a little money. Go away. Right? Send you off. And again, no problem because I'm going to make this money back probably within a week. But, you know, really what it means to die to myself is just to give up things. Or even if there's a part of us that does die, oftentimes it's only just a small part of our identity. Maybe you have some small bad habit that you just want to get it fixed, you want to get it removed, and you do that for the Lord. But ultimately, most of who we are stays intact. Nothing really changes. The greatest amazing thing about this passage is that what he's calling you to do is not just to give up your rights, but to die to yourself, right? That you are no longer made for you, you no longer live for you. Everything that you do is to be done for another, and that's for God who should be given all the glory. This is the most powerful thing in this passage because it's talking about dying to yourself. This is what dying to yourself looks like, right? That you're not just dying to physical things, you're dying to your physical temptations, your physical appetites and desires. And you're giving all of that up. You're being generous with your time and your money for the sake of the kingdom of God. You know, after reading this passage, I hope you do what I do, or what I did, and was to look. I went to my bathroom mirror. I took a really good look at myself, and I asked myself, does all my time, does all my possessions, does my bank account, does the way that I react to others, is all of this done for me? Or am I actually doing these things because God has so desired me to do these things? God's will for your life is to deny yourself, to die to yourself, to put the needs of others above your own, And he calls every person who calls himself a Christian to live like this. Number three, we are not to be of this world. We are not of this world. Therefore, our rights exist in a kingdom not of this world. To die to yourself also means to die to the entitlement of this world, the things that we think that we deserve. This is why the Bible calls us exiles and sojourners, to emphasize this idea that while we are on earth, we are not at home. We are in a place. We are not in a place that we belong. We can enjoy some of the rights while here, but they should not be taken as if they are assured. We have a purpose being here on this earth, that sometimes it calls us to go beyond what the law requires if it brings God more praise, but also calls us to limit some of those rights we are assigned if it brings God more glory. So sometimes we're going to call, or this purpose that we have calls us to go beyond what the law requires of us, and sometimes that we have to limit our rights, all to bring God more glory. And we do have promises that are in heaven. We do have promises, and we do have rewards, but they are in heaven. And we will never, and they will never, 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 never be found here on this earthly kingdom. I have two more points here. I'm going to be quick. Two more points, and then we're going to come to the conclusion, just to be very clear. Pastor Warner last week talked about George Mueller, and I posted a link up to an audio biography on the Life page. If you haven't had a chance to listen to it, or if you have listened to it, I hope you were blessed by it. If you haven't, I would go home and listen to it right away. George Mueller was a 19th century evangelist as well. Again, he was a very unique personality within himself. As if anybody ever reads his biography, you'll notice that he has a very unique personality. But he's also known as a person known for his faith. And he's probably the best person I can best exemplify that as a sinful human being about what it means to live the Christian life or to be a Christian. And these are the words of George Mueller here. There was a day when I died to George Mueller, his opinions, preferences, tastes, and will, died to the world, its approval or censure, died to the approval or blame even to my own brethren or friends. And since then, I have studied only to show myself approved unto God. Right, this is what it looks like for Christians to die to themselves. This is what every Christian should say if they want to die to themselves. But we should all be saying, looking at the words that George Mueller said and saying amen, because I think this is what it looks to die to yourself. But the most important case, the one that's most relevant to us, is Jesus models what dying to yourself looks like. It says, let each of you look not only to his own interests, but also to the interest of others. Have this mind among ourselves, which is yours in Christ Jesus, who though he was from God, did not count equality with God a thing to be grasped, but emptied himself by taking on the form of a servant, being born in the likeness of men, and being found in human form. He humbled himself by becoming obedient to the point of death, even death on a cross. Jesus here tells us to do all these things, but he himself has lived a life of denying himself, of dying to himself, where Jesus calls us to accept insult, to be seen as lowly or more lowly than others. Jesus himself becomes human where he could have stayed divine and experienced perfection as the triune God, where he calls us to abandon our time, everything, Everything he did on this earth was in service to God, everything. He calls us to abandon our personal rights and property. But look at Jesus. He didn't just abandon abandon these rights. He gave his life so that anybody who believes upon him may have eternal life and be transformed by sanctification, by sanctifying and justification, so they could become more like him. If we're looking for a model for what it looks like to deny yourself, look no further than in your Bible when you see Jesus dying on the cross. Let's conclude here. The passage goes from retaliation, talks about retaliation. So it goes from what you deserve to what do you need. This is a huge gulf of what happens in this passage, right? Because what people deserve is technically justice, right? If they insult you, if they persecute you, if they steal from you, there should be justice. But believers are called to not ask and to not dispense what you deserve, but really ask, what is it that you need? Secondly, Dying to yourself is dying to your rights. Right? It's not just to give up physical things, but there are certain things in this life that you have to give up for the sake of God's kingdom, for the sake of God's glory, for the sake of the other person. Because if you show no transformation, why should they believe your message? Right? You talk about Jesus dying on the cross for everybody, but there's been no change in your life. Number three, living for Christ is a calling to extreme radical living. I hope that as we talked about this passage today, that everybody is going to go home and think about something's got to change. Because that's what happened to me. I went home August 6th, the first time I preached, and I went home and I'm like, something has to change here. I cannot keep living this way. My mind cannot wrap a way that I'm living right now based on what I'm reading here. Very lastly here, are there real considerations in our life? So like I said, there are some contexts that change the way in which we live out some of these examples. But how seriously are we about living this way? Seriously about giving up the rights, seriously about giving up our time and our money to anybody who asks? How serious about dying to ourselves are we? Because this is God's call for all of our lives. Thank you.